Again, good morning or afternoon, everyone, depending on where you are, and welcome to emforum.org. I am Amy Sebring, and will serve as your host or moderator, and we are very glad you could join us today. We will be providing some instructions as we go along for any first-timers, so you can relax and participate with us. We do want you to participate. Now, if you need assistance, you may use the hand-raising button on your participants panel, and either Ava Jean or Lori will try to help you via the chat panel. But once you have been helped, please do lower your hand again. Now, today we are going to hear about some of the initiatives that the National Emergency Management Association, that's NEMA, has been working on this year, not only on behalf of the state EMAs, but also on behalf of local emergency management programs across the country. There are several related links on today's background page that you can check out later if you haven't already, including one to NEMA testimony at a recent congressional hearing. You might find that interesting. But first, for the benefit of our newcomers, we will begin with an overview presentation, and then we are going to proceed to your questions or comments. We will provide further instructions just before we begin the Q&A, but we ask you not to submit your question or comment until we get to that part of the program. We are making a recording, which should be available later this afternoon, along with a copy of today's slides, and then the text transcript will be posted early next week. Now, if you are not on our mailing list, you can subscribe from our homepage, and then you will get a notice when these materials are ready, as well as notices of future programs. Now, it is my great pleasure to welcome back James M. Mullen, current president of NEMA and director of the Washington State Emergency Management Division since 2004. He previously served as director of emergency management for the city of Seattle for 12 years, so it is not surprising that he has been an outspoken advocate of local and county emergency managers. Jim was last with us when he chaired the mitigation committee for NEMA, and if you're interested in that, that program is in our archives. Please do check out today's background page for further biographical detail and a link to Jim's blog where you can provide additional feedback. Now, welcome back, Jim. Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us today. I now turn the floor over to you to start us off, please.
Thank you very much, Amy, and hello to everybody, whether it's morning or afternoon. I appreciate you joining us today. Today I want to describe some of the challenging issues that have been taken on by NEMA during my extended tenure as president. As many of you may know, I became president kind of prematurely when the director in Iowa was not retained by the new governor, and something that happened to probably 19 of my colleagues over a period of several months after the 2010 elections. So I had to serve both his term, and I'm nearing the end of mine in October. And I want to describe some of the challenging issues that we've taken on, and because they will continue for some time after my term ends. Everyone's probably noticed the decline in federal funding over the past few years. That's a decline that can be expected to continue, or at least not reverse itself, unless a new crisis emerges. The first concern, of course, for most of us has been EMPG, the Emergency Management Performance Grant. And the current issues revolve around the future of the Homeland Security Grant Program and its suite of grant programs. The political environment has been difficult at best. Some of the questions I get from reporters, fueled from some self-styled experts from D.C.-based foundations and refugees from the previous administration, are, why are there so many disasters now? And the more relevant question Congress is asking, how do we know that our return on investment is adequate and effective? So with that, I'm going to talk a little bit about our communications with Congress. And you see on the slides, and I probably won't read them all to you. In March of 2011, NEMA and IAM combined on a paper which is listed up there and is available on various websites that described what we were doing with EMPG. And the reception to the report was excellent. And what we've tried to do, generally speaking, in our communications with Congress is
the first question and the inquiries that have been resulting from some of the press folks that I've had to talk to have tended towards almost partisan-laced attacks on FEMA, whereas the question of effectiveness has been a very appropriate and responsible question for Congress to be posing. And so that's why VEMA and IAM decided to get together in 2011 and produce the report that's referenced on your screen. After years of trying to respond anecdotally and after years of wringing our hands trying to justify EMPG, this report triggered an excellent response from congressional staff. I think we finally applied our own rule that we apply to all exercises that don't fight the scenario by saying we've stopped fighting the question, we're dealing with it. And we've answered the questions, and the results speak for themselves in terms of, in the midst of a lot of slippage in grant support, EMPGs remain pretty strong. And we've received very powerful reinforcement in the hallways and the conference rooms from congressional staff that we need to keep that kind of exchange up, and we are doing that. It worked so well that NEMA updated that document in March 2012 on EMPG again. IAM submitted its own report around that time, and I should say here on behalf of NEMA that we supported both the joint paper that the two associations prepared, but also the separate submissions. Our association's focus can be different while we're pursuing the same objective. And NEMA has always been supportive of both our common interests and the individual integrity of all of our stakeholders. In a congressional hearing a few days later, after we published I'll call EMPG 2, I gave a response to the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee that not only addressed his question but provides a clue to the answer to the first question I had mentioned earlier regarding the number of disasters and this kind of snarky, persistent suggestion that perhaps we're inventing these disasters. The question related to how we measure the worth of EMPG, and I replied that there were in 2011 98 presidential disasters, about 250 state disaster declarations where federal assistance was not needed, and over 13,000 instances when there was minimal state involvement needed, if any at all. And I suggested that was because EMPG has allowed local and state preparedness to develop to the point that we can tamp down events before they can escalate. And the message, I hope, was clear. If you don't have EMPG, that number of 98 in a really bad year could well have become 300 or 400 presidential declarations because the capacity to interdict a crisis would not be there. It's kind of a variation of It's a Wonderful Life theme where the angel tells Georgia, well, if you haven't been there, we would have had even worse situation than you're facing right now. And the fact is it's true that if emergency management wasn't there at the ground level, the number of disasters would escalate, the severity of disasters would escalate, and the ability of the American people to really be protected the way they have a right to expect would be diminished substantially. So EMPG minimized what was already a bad year, and it could have been much worse. And I just think that the attempts to use a bad year like that to attack FEMA and suggest that it's really easy to get a declaration these days is incorrect and self-serving for those who are making that argument. We found it to be more exacting than ever. But I think folks in Joplin and Tuscaloosa would agree with us that this was just a bad year, and thank heaven we had some capabilities that allowed us to address those problems. So that brings me to Homeland Security grant reform and some of the discussions that we've been engaged in for some time. While we've been successful in answering the mail on EMPG, that hasn't been the case with the suite of Homeland Security grant programs to date. There seemed in the spring of last year to be a disconnect, a yearning among stakeholders to return to the 2008 funding levels or just leave things the way they were. But when Congress cannot get a handle on the return on investment, that is, performance measures, then blind funding is not going to occur. They're not going to just continue to go down the same path when dollars are tight everywhere. And to argue to leave things the way they are is just unrealistic. Now, those who launched DHS in 2003 did some good things. But the current critics should recall that the influx of dollars under Homeland Security was indeed a rushed process. Congress was anxious to respond to emerging threats. DHS wanted to justify its existence. The administration emphasized things being purchased, masks, radios, and contractors of varying expertise and quality instead of staff at the local and state level. and really downgraded the contributions of permanent staff, as if locals and states weren't already busy before 9/11. The suggestion was sort of implied that, well, you guys just need to turn your attention to things that the federal government thinks is important. Penetrating questions such as what problem exactly are we trying to fix were lost in a bewildering web of process and information bulletins and contradictory rulings. And who can forget the sudden data calls for more information, calls that were more numerous than anyone needed to have, and certainly asking for information that was sometimes really obscure, but was always needed immediately. It matters little today whether this was done for political effect or in a sincere desire to protect the country. More likely, it was a combination of both. What matters is some things worked, some things did not work, and no one measured the achievement to any great extent. And, of course, in most of those cases, the performance measure might have been, did you buy the truck? Where's the truck? There's the truck. You met your performance measure. We're a lot more sophisticated in both what we are able to do now and what I think is required from Congress and the administrations that we've dealt with lately. After 8 years, we at NEMA thought it ought to be possible to launch a national dialogue to see if we as a nation and as stakeholders had learned any new approaches. And so working with the Governor's Homeland Security Advisory Committee, and they ended up not signing off on our document but not disagreeing with it either. We simply used them as a backdrop to help us kind of get the perspective of Homeland Security Advisors. We launched an initiative that would that really wanted to propose a new funding model, a structure. And we're really looking at it in terms of grant reform. In looking at our national accomplishments, we were able to say that despite all the sturm and drang that had gone on, some very good things had been achieved by two administrations that are local and state counterparts. We could say this has not been a waste of time and money. But the first step that we had to take was to establish the effectiveness of the programs sufficiently. Because those are the building blocks to future reform. In July of 2011, the easy part of our two-part effort illustrated the effectiveness of Homeland Security efforts over the life of the program and highlighted some more recent events where it was very clear that coordination that had not been in place years before was now there because of the Homeland Security programs. And we got a very positive reaction from Congress, who was the primary audience for this. We had documented some of the things that had gone well, and I think they were appreciative of that. We didn't do this in a vacuum, and I want to make this very clear. As the report was drafted, we did an extensive outreach to IAM leadership and staff and other stakeholders throughout the remainder of the year. We got a limited response from most people. We were kind of out there, and it was probably because there were still a lot of people clinging to the view that we needed to get Congress to turn and the administration to turn and go back and fund at higher levels, which would be very desirable. But it was our belief that that was not going to happen, that the economy wasn't going to get better, that the political environment wasn't going to get stronger, and that the questions that we were getting about the effectiveness of the programs and the way they're being managed would get louder and louder and more persistent and more persistent. So we felt we should at least add something to the discussion. We announced well in advance that we would submit a report by the end of 2011. We actually did the more extensive report on January 3rd of 2012. And we provided a lot of people with advance information on what was in the report, and including leaking something that ended up being deleted from the report in August of 2011. But certainly by November and December, a lot of people were seeing the document with some comment, but not a tremendous amount of dialogue going on other than, oh, thank you. The principles of the grant reform were to support the PPDA mission areas. We wanted to do something with EMPG that I think maybe made some people a little nervous, but we wanted to say this is a sustainable model. Congress is beginning to realize, and really has now realized and asserted, that it's a good program. The 50-50 match is essential. It provides local and state flexibility in decision-making. It has a lot to recommend it. And therefore, it's a decent model. Some of the rigidity of the Homeland Security Grant Program could be eased to allow a more flexible approach so that you can be agile, adaptive, and accountable at the same time because our enemies, frankly, and that's what Homeland Security funding is aimed at, is protecting us from our enemies. Our enemies don't have the kind of rules we have. We need to be able to change direction when something happens and do it in a way that is done at the ground level, where a local government says, you know what, this is a bigger problem than this other thing we thought was a big problem. We need to move it around. And that's a simple thing to do. That decision can be made by local authorities, consultation with the state, but certainly not a thumb on them. I think most of us would be very eager to go with new information. But the other point was that in addition to the flexibility, the country deserves to be safe, secure, but also solvent. And so to tell Congress, we're not asking for money. We're asking for a structure that allows us to be as capable as we can be with the resources you're able to give us. So it's not a legislative document that we've provided. It's not a plea for specific dollars. We talked about it, but we took it out in the end because we thought it was inappropriate, that's not what we were talking about, that our issues were structural and related to being top-heavy in terms of the prescriptive decisions or recommendations we had to follow. We were believing that more and more information and more decision-making should be made at the other end of the spectrum, at the local and at state level. It was not the sole answer to the concerns of Congress or stakeholders. We really thought there would be others joining us, either saying these guys are completely wrong or saying we like this but we don't like that, or have you thought about another aspect of the problem? We actually believed that would be the case, and it's still there to do it. We're open to it. At no time, and even in the text of our report, we asserted that we wanted to have a dialogue, that we weren't out there trying to win a case. We were trying to raise an issue. And we were not being state-centric at all, even though we're state directors. There are clear references to local collaboration in the document and in everything we've said about it ever since, because really we only can do so much. The rest of it is done on the ground where most things happen. One of the key proposal components is to have a cadre-based allocation. It recognizes there's a need for staff to carry out planning assessments and grant administration and other Homeland Security functions. I think that's pretty clear that you can't do things without staff. And the MPG as a model could improve the Homeland Security grant system, but there's a clear, bright line between those two programs, just as there's a clear, bright line between those functions. And EMPG stands alone among federal grant programs with its 50-50 match, which I think is a good thing for us, and it's probably one of the key features in why Congress has such respect and regard for it, because I think they know, as we all should know, that we are more than matching as a nation at the local and state level the 50% match, and if they ever matched ours, we might have trouble spending all that money if they ever came up to our level. But that's okay. Things are tough, and when we were challenged, and we were challenged a few times by staff in one caucus or another, we'd say simply, we're overmatching now. Our hand is not out. And that's because we have a local responsibility. But if you're developing a national Homeland Security program, that's a different story. That's a whole discussion you need to have. And really, the key thing here was we wanted to get Homeland Security away from the anti-staff bias, the notion that we could just take on work because the feds are giving us money but restricting our hiring. Some of you who've been around a long time remember, while it's loosened up a little bit, there still are vestiges of let's buy stuff because that's appropriate. And really one of the big problems in my personal judgment, this is just a state director individually speaking now, one of the big problems for why we made purchases of so much stuff was it was within the guidelines. But if we'd been really free to operate and do what we thought was necessary, we would have probably hired planners and planners who would be with us after their plans were written, who would be able to see the impacts of it. In other words, we'd have hired permanent staff, and a whole different kind of construct would have come out of that at the local level, and we wouldn't have been living from year to year so much trying to figure out what we do next. So my hope is that a skilled cadre will emerge from this, and it will be recognized that it takes people to do work and to carry out missions. It seems to have been missed at times, but I think we're getting around to that point of view. Improved planning and assessments. I'll mention the item on the bottom first. Years ago, in my misspent youth, as a much younger person in the City of Seattle's Law and Justice Planning Office, there was a program called the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration. And it basically developed system improvement and other types of operational improvement grant programs for, in our case, the city, for law enforcement, how to reduce crime. So the Block Watch program, a rape reduction program, a youth accountability bureau program for youths under 18 that got in trouble, things like that. But we didn't just fund those things by getting money. We started with, what's the mission? Reduce crime. What's our plan? Well, we would write a plan that was a pretty collaborative document. And then we'd say, what are the projects that would allow us to fill the gaps that we've identified in our plan? And that's when we'd start thinking about what it would cost to meet those requirements. And then the federal government would give us the money based on those requirements. Now, we wouldn't always get all the money that we needed to do every project, but we extended those projects for 2 or 3 years and would find out that maybe we finished a demonstration project and could transfer money into some lower level priority that was still pretty important. But that was a notion. It was a very well-run program. It ended, President Carter actually wiped it out in the late, around 1980, but it worked for many years in the 1970 era, and the concept is still valid. Before you start spending money, you have to know what your priorities are, and you have to have an idea of how you're going to attack your gaps. And so that's one of the concepts that's built into what we've been talking about here. And I really think it makes some sense. And again, we're all open to counter arguments. Investment grants. By having project-based funding, we can build in the measures to be developed, and therefore the performance measures and the evaluation design can be part of any project that's going to be funded. And again, that's what we did with, for example, Block Watch, which started actually in the City of Seattle about 40 years ago. The purpose was to reduce crime, but we didn't want to displace crime. So we measured the reduction in burglary and then tested it against census tracts that were just outside the area that was being targeted, and we were able to determine whether or not we were actually just displacing crime or reducing crime, and it turned out it was effective at reducing crime. But you build the measure in to the grant proposal, the grant description, so that you can actually find out whether it worked or not, whether it's worth continuing or not, and that's an important feature of this. We believe that the SAA and local governments and the consortium jurisdictions would work together on a completed threat hazard identification, risk assessment, and a comprehensive preparedness strategy. We'd probably tie all that together. And that would allow us to target what we're going to invest in. There'd be a multidisciplinary review by local and state teams within the jurisdictions. The next line is where we part ways with, I think, the president's budget. National peer reviews would be eliminated in this way. We would say stakeholder decision-making is much better. The local level is the best place to determine what the local needs are. We would want to be supportive of that. We might have something to say about it, but we're certainly not going to legislate that to anybody at the state level. We really think it's important that
that we have that discussion at the lowest possible level and get the dollars flowing more quickly. We can, again, if we have good evaluation models and tools, you can determine whether we spent the money wisely or not after the fact. So that's one piece of that's important. We believe the Tier 1 UWASIs, however many there are at any given point in time, probably should still be funded directly. That's an issue we leave to those who have the clearances and the understanding of who should be Tier 1. All other urban areas, though, are in the game because they're eligible for the other parts of the program, and they have the right to form their own consortia and work regionally or interjurisdictionally on projects that relate to them. So we think there's some value in looking at that. And again, by no means are we saying this is the only way to do it. This is just a dialogue that we want to get started. The advantages we see is that everyone who's now eligible remains eligible. We're tired of the winning and losing aspects of this. The whole community is increasingly given an opportunity to plan together and work together and not have notes where that's not happening. The SAA would have increased visibility over activities to protect the state. Now, I'll just say currently I have one of the more knowledgeable SAAs in the country, certainly one of the most experienced ones, and he can't tell the governor what's going on in her state to 100% level because he doesn't really know what the port and the transit folks are doing. It's not that there's anything wrong with that. They are operating under the rules and regulations that they have. But it would make much more sense for us to do complementary planning if we're all in the room together. Now, it's more difficult. It's messier. It's contentious at times. But we found in this state, I'd like to think, that we have a pretty good way of getting at those solutions. It isn't pretty all the time, but everyone cares about their jurisdiction. Everyone understands their obligations outside their jurisdiction to the whole community, and everyone pitches in, and we usually get a fairly decent consensus out of those efforts. And that's about what you can expect, and that's probably something we need to do. Planning together, though, helps us because I learn a lot more about the perspective of another jurisdiction if I hear what their concerns are and what the problem they're trying to solve. And it will be easier, I believe, if we do this all together for Congress and even the nation itself to track the results and see how we're doing in this. And so I think one of the things I've been more acutely aware of is some of the concerns and considerations that people have had. And I'd say, first of all, change is scary. But frankly, we made the calculation last summer that change was happening anyway, that there was no question that reductions were coming. A better and smarter way to manage the funds that we would get had to occur. And in fact, even if the dollars went up, it wouldn't hurt after all these years to come up with the smartest, best way to spend whatever dollars came to us, because we're not going to win this battle that we're in if we fail to adapt and change and recognize trends and improve our performance on a regular basis. So as the dollars decline, there will be less for everybody theoretically, but my experience in Homeland Security and urban area programs is everyone ends up working together for the same objective anyway. One of the questions that comes up is, well, I'll lose if I sit down with those other people. And I heard this a lot. And you know what? We need to be able to sit down and trust each other to come up with a consensus. And sure, you won't get what you want in every instance, but you will do better that way than if we sit here in our stovepipes watching the life get sucked out of most of the programs and have it depend on who's got the best lobby, or if you aren't legally allowed to lobby, the best educational outreach program. That's not necessarily the way to either run a railroad or protect the nation. So that's why we've gone to this suggestion. And the conclusion is we need dialogue. We don't need to fight with each other. Everybody's ideas are welcome.
the ideas we get today, the ideas you think about overnight or in a few weeks, the ideas that associations come up with, they can be counter to ours because we make no pretext that we know everything. But a nearly a decade of experience should allow us to reconstitute our system to assure Congress and the nation that their investment in our collective efforts is justified. And I read that one without paraphrasing it for a reason. I think that is the principle that we really need to follow. There are successful building blocks in these Homeland Security programs. It has not been a lost cause. We have done great things, and we've had some fits and starts, too. But we can do better than we have done, and with less money, we're going to have to do better together than we've ever done. So with that, apparently I've come to the end of my comments. So I will now open it up for questions and turn it back to Amy to tell me what we're going to do next.
Okay. Thank you very much, Jim. And I did, again, want to mention that on our background page for today's program, that we do have links to most of the reports that you mentioned.
Thank you.
Okay, now we will proceed to our Q&A. The main point here is you will type your Q&A or your question or comment into the Q&A panel. Please do not put it into the chat panel. And then you just type it in there and hit enter, click on send. As they come in, hopefully, I will read the question aloud, and then, Jim, you'll just address it over the bridge as we move on. Now, it may take a moment or two to for folks to think about what they want to ask about. Again, try to keep it on today's topic, but anything relating to these various grant programs should be fair game. To start us off, I wanted to ask you, Jim, I'm not necessarily up on the latest and greatest information on the 2012 grants, but my understanding was that the Homeland Security Secretary was given pretty broad discretion on how those funds were going to be allocated. Has that taken place yet?
The discretion is there. I don't believe that it's I will tell you that FEMA is proceeding as if that's what's going to happen, but I don't really know if those allocation decisions have been made yet, and I'm not sure that they've really got that that's been adopted. But I think there's every intent to do that. I think Congress is probably more focused on the next budget,
right,
in terms of the 2013 decisions. That's really where I've been focusing my attention. Whatever they do this year, they're going to do.
Right, and kind of give us a sense where you see this going in the future in terms of NEMA's efforts, you know, what needs to happen over the next months.
Well, we're hopeful that there will be some, and we aren't necessarily going to lead it, but we're going to continue to talk to Congress and our colleagues about ideas that we have. I would suspect that it's probably incumbent on DHS through FEMA to continue to work with stakeholders and have some meaningful dialogue about where we need to go. I suspect that because they're pretty much constrained by, I mean, they have to support the president's budget because that's who they work for, that may take a while for an open dialogue to occur. But it's very clear to me that the Senate and the House both expect the stakeholders to solve the issue and come and tell them together what we think needs to happen. And the reason I say that is I don't think they want us to have a battle on their conference room table. They want us to come to terms with the realities that the country's facing, the budget realities. They want us to come up with some kind of system. I think the grant reform path, the president's budget, begins to take us, that our proposal takes us, is sort of somewhere in that realm we're going to end up there. Again, I think it's incumbent on all of the stakeholder associations to try to come to a consensus about what they agree on, at least, and what shape these programs should take, because we're the ones in the country who ought to know more about this than anybody. I'm a state director. I've been a local director. I don't, for 20 years now, I don't claim to know everything either. I'm still hearing things that are news to me, and I think that's probably true of most of us if we're really trying every day, and therefore coming together, we could come up with perhaps
some common principles or common ideas that that would allow us to give Congress advice before they do something. One of the things that always troubled me about the way DHS came about and the way some of the rules came out was we were always reacting to what people who knew less than we did as an emergency management community, to what they were telling us had to happen, that we weren't getting involved early enough before the decisions were made. And I would submit to you that while one association or another may not know everything, together all of us know just about everything, and we can be probably very helpful both to each other and to the nation if we can come up with at least some basic principles. We have a bunch of them in our paper. I would encourage people to look at it and say, what do I not agree with? Or what's missing? And tell us. And then you probably convince us. But the point is, together we can come up with a set of proposals or a set of concepts, dollar-free, just here's what this country needs. This is how we need to do it. This is who needs to be accountable for it. And this is how we're going to be able to justify our efforts to you. That's what is a proper question for Congress to be asking. And it's a proper thing for us to say as subject matter experts, we're the ones that should be the ones commenting on this. I mean, in a sense, the people on this call, the people that you represent and work with, are the generals and the foot soldiers in the war that people should be listening to before they make decisions.
Thank you. Let me ask one quick follow-up question. When you talk about stakeholders and the associations, of course you're aware that, you know, PPD-8 really has a big chunk in there that relates perhaps more to the law enforcement community. And I know, of course, at the state level, you're coordinating with those folks every day. But is NEMA working with any state law enforcement, you know, associations or law enforcement, national law enforcement associations on this effort?
We're willing to talk to the Metropolitan Police Chiefs have talked to us about this. I think they're approaching it their way. We're open to talk to any law enforcement group, and I think our association staff have probably been in touch, keeping regular communication with those folks, but we haven't asked anyone to sign on to it. We simply said, here's what we think. What do you think?
Gotcha.
And it's a dialogue thing. We're not trying to be the support arm. We're not trying to be the lever. We're trying to just drive at least the fact that we better talk about this before decisions are made on our behalf without us having the input that we probably need.
I'm going to take a quick question from Isabel McCurdy. Basically, she's asking for a little more explanation of what FAA, that's the State Administrative Agency, is, and asked to elaborate just a little bit.
Okay. In each state, a state administrative agent is identified by the governor. And that is the person who, in our state, is the Homeland Security Advisor, the Adjutant General of the Military Department. In other states, it can be someone the governor decided to appoint. It could be the Emergency Management Director. In some states, the Emergency Management Director is also the Homeland Security Advisor. It varies. In about half of our states, I believe that's the case. I'm not. I work for an Adjutant General. The Adjutant General for the state of Washington, who's the Director of the Military Department, is the Homeland Security Advisor and the State Administrative Agent. But emergency management manages the grants that flow through there. So that's the relationship. I hope that's helpful to you. That's who I'm talking about when I talk about the SAA. So when the Adjutant General, who's the governor's principal advisor, has to go and tell her, this is what's going on in your state, in my case, Washington State, he's got to tell her, as far as I know, I don't know. This is what we're doing. This is how we're coordinating. These are the procedures we're going. This is the state of affairs of protecting the state that you're the governor for, as far as I know, because there's elements of programs that aren't under him that he doesn't have visibility on to the level that would make him more comfortable. And I think that's true of most SAAs, where there are independent programs that are stovepiped beyond our, the ability to coordinate. Now, we've had some good success in this state lately with the transit folks are coming into to the discussion, and I think that's a very, very good thing. They're going to join our urban area working group, as I understand it. That's a wonderful thing. We just need to work to make sure we have everyone in the room and have to promise not to pick their pockets, but simply pick their brains and get the benefit of their expertise, and over time, it'll all work out.
I have a question from Barb Graff, who did not put it in the Q&A panel, so I won't be able to display it, but she asked, Jim, many states are suffering significant full-time employee cutbacks given local and state economies. Talk with us about the ability of states to administer this increased workload associated with this new structure.
What was the last part of that?
Basically, she's looking for, talk with us about the ability of states to administer this increased workload associated with this new structure. In other words, she's saying we've got less people to do the same amount of work or more work. How, you know, what do you recommend?
Okay. I actually think this might simplify the workload to a certain extent, but by shifting this here, we're not necessarily shifting the burdens we don't already have. If we had to do more management of more grants, and the structure was such that there was a direct interaction, there's more direct interaction at the local level, I suspect we could all absorb that a little bit better, because the key thing would be, locals holding themselves accountable, states holding themselves accountable. I just don't think we'd have a big problem with that. The workload's going to remain the same. Even for 2-3 years after all these monies are gone, if the programs disappeared, there'd be a grant requirement that we'd have to absorb. So I will tell you this, that my experience is that what state fiscal or budget analysts ask is, do we have to track this, do this job? And if it's a federal mandate, they're more likely to approve that. We're more likely to have to shift resources if we do need more assets to track and monitor grant performance. But I don't think that's going to be as huge a problem. It's interesting, none of the state directors who had questions about any aspects of this proposal ever suggested that this would make it harder for them to administer grants. And it was posed to them in our executive session, well, does this thing make things more or less complicated? And they actually felt it gave us more surety in terms of where the money was coming and what the rules would be. So my short answer is I don't think that would be a huge burden. Staffing is always going to be a burden. And I'd be interested, though, in knowing if that was creating a burden, if you perceive that as being creating a burden at the local level, because it's one thing for me to blithely say, oh, yeah, we can manage that, but if it created burdens at the local level, we could probably begin to address that in this dialogue.
I also have a question from Ava Jean, and she says, Jim, thanks for your thought-provoking presentation today. I take from what you said that you didn't get the amount of input or feedback that you hoped for from stakeholders regarding the Homeland Security Grant Reform Report. Why do stakeholders not grasp that they have a lot of clout? What can we do to emphasize this to local practitioners and your state peers?
Well, I think that's really important to, and maybe it's because I can't see an issue without commenting on it anyway. And those of you on this call who know me know that I'm not shy. But I would say that one of the things that is a block is when representatives or association staff or some group hears something, it's how much news do they get to take back? What's the feedback mechanism within associations, I guess? How much independence out of necessity or out of just structure does a committee chair have, or a association staff, an outreach person in D.C. have? That's the question that each association has to answer. If they're satisfied they're getting this information. I would have liked to have heard from presidents, vice presidents, officials, board members of any of the associations more about any concerns they had with the proposal, because that's how we can answer those questions or adjust our approach. So I don't want to be critical of anybody. I do think that probably there was a combination of things. One was here was something that was running against what everyone wanted to see happen. Everyone wanted to see the bleeding stop and have the abruptness of the cuts in Homeland Security be halted so we could take a deep breath and let locals in particular begin to adjust to some of the reduced dollars. As much as the reduction is a problem, the abruptness of the reduction has been a greater problem because all of a sudden you're going as fast as you can and then you've got to slow down to half speed and realize that you're going to have to slow cut your speed by another half in a year, and you begin to wonder why you're running at all. Why are you even in the race? And so my guess is that that was a conflict between the push to try to save what we had and the idea of readjusting to the what some of us think is the new reality. Frankly, I think the only way we'll ever get increases is if we reform the structure of the grants and can show people beyond the shadow of a doubt what we're doing, but what would be possible if more funds were put into it. Because I honestly believe that if we were doing this kind of a project and it was successful, we'd be able to be more successful in getting resources because the Congress would know exactly what they're getting when they appropriated the money and allocated the funds.
Question from Al Goodman, who asks, are natural hazards considered in this process or in the grant reform, I expect?
Well, to an extent, I guess. I mean, one of the things that I expect would be a little controversial is the notion that we accept in the grant proposal that mitigation has got to be in every conversation on the Homeland Security investment side. And the reason is that I believe that if you leave the PDM program, pre-disaster mitigation program, on its own, you're going to watch it shrink and shrink and shrink. In fact, it actually has been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking in the last 2 or 3 or 4 years. The power of the argument is that if you retrofit a building and mitigate against an earthquake, and I'll use my parochial area as an example, you can convince, I think, over time in discussion, a fire chief that he doesn't have to send his search and rescue people in to save as many people and put his people at risk if we've mitigated the building. So you can convince a public safety professional of the power of mitigation in preventing damage and minimizing negative consequences and risks to their own people. That belongs in the discussion with all the other things that relate to disaster preparedness. And so, yes, I think there's a point where we should do it. Now, some of my friends in PDM, and I think I have a few left, despite the supporting this proposal, have argued that we'll lose if we get in there. Well, I think we should trust our argument. Mitigation makes more sense than almost anything that we do. And pre-disaster mitigation, identifying the risks and moving forward, that's the proper place for it. We're not going to win that argument with our stovepipe program with a leak in the bottom of the boat. We're going to have to win that argument by plugging it in with all those other activities and saying, we belong in here too. And I think that's true of any, whether you're a port or a transit authority or a city or a county, we really need to look at what's most important and take care of those things. And I think that's, I just think that's the way to go.
Thank you. No questions in the queue. Anybody, if you've got comments, questions, ideas that, you'd like us to consider in the context of the discussion, please pop them in. I was struck by your remarks, and I guess I've heard this before, Jim, about, again, this goes back to the cadre, the staffing. It seems like because there's not any long-term assurance from year to year that you'll have funding for specific positions, that a lot of this planning work and so forth has to kind of be farmed out to contractors. You want to talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, I'll try not to destroy any future career opportunities.
And I am a contractor, so I can ask this.
Oh, yeah, you can, and I'll try not to destroy any future career opportunities themselves by saying how I feel about contracting. But I will say this. It's much better if you're going to develop a sustained effort to have sustained staff. And contractors can do some things, but they can't do everything. And they certainly
can't possibly match the value of a local Homeland Security person who's trained and who understands preparedness principles, understands the community they're planning for. You may need some outside expertise to do some of that work. You may need outside expertise to put together the telecommunications meeting that you're going to have to discuss what you really need. But you really don't need to have contractors for the sake of contracting. I mean, it's certainly not at the expense of staff. I'll just say this, and this is relates to the top off two exercise where I probably began to form some of my judgments about the overuse of contracting. We were sitting in a room planning for the top off two exercise, and we pointed out that we needed to do a recovery piece in this, which we sort of did in the end. That was the first time anyone really said, you know, the King County and Seattle said, we've got to really talk about recovery after this event. This is a huge issue. And the contractors were totally blown away by this. They said, well, what do you mean? Well, there's an effect on the urban economy. How would we measure that? Well, we'd probably get an urban economist. Where would we find one? And the whole idea was there's no concept of the long-range impacts to that community of that event. It was totally focused on the event. Why? Because that was what their contract was. That's what their reason for being in our city and our county at that time was, to carry out that contract. Now, if you're sitting in that same community and you say, let's for example say you're working for Barb Graff as an employee, and that question comes up, they know that in addition to handling that event and getting through that thing, there are consequences that have to be followed. In fact, they knew that before it happened. So they're working on those issues on a regular basis, and they have the people tied together to do that, and they are attempting to achieve a rhythm from beginning to end, or a loop, a circle of activity that allows them to continue to work together. When you need specific expertise, then you go buy it, but it never supplants the core responsibilities of the government that's brought them in. That core responsibility includes planning for consequences, planning for response, and planning for recovery. All of that stuff needs to be done in-house. And the contractors, it wasn't their fault. We were all restricted from using staff as if that was something really bad, and contractors were something that was the panacea for all ills. And I think it was a disservice to contractors as well as to local governments that philosophy was allowed to prevail so powerfully for so many years. And hopefully we're getting farther and farther away from that.
Yeah, I guess I was kind of driving at the fact that you have to do your planning year to year. You never know, you know. And this is just our budget process in the United States. We go through it every year, you know. And in other words, not having like a longer-term view of what's needed over the next 5 years.
And the other thing is that our idea is that if they adopted some version of grant reform that was along the lines we're talking about, there'd be more certainty and there'd be time given to actually measure the performance of these programs and evaluate them and make course corrections and do whatever you needed to do. Again, that's the agility and adaptivity that we've been talking about. You wouldn't be dinged if your idea didn't work. If your idea didn't work, that's a good thing, because then you know what you should not do. And that's part of any evaluation. And I'll go back to a single fingerprint project we did in law enforcement years and years ago. We got a National Exemplary Award from LEAA, the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, and then we terminated it because our evaluators said it didn't work. And it was embarrassing a little bit, but the fact was it didn't work until 20 years later, when technology got to the point where you really could make an identification. But we were running more effective than ever, but you couldn't convict anyone based on that. So if you couldn't do that, that was what we were trying to do, is find a way to connect criminals to a crime. And we couldn't be sure it was right. So even though it improved the performance and it was faster, it wasn't as accurate, and we couldn't depend on it. So we abandoned it until technology caught up with our bright ideas. But you want your evaluation to say, did it work or not? You really need to know the answer to that. And you have to be unflinching and say, okay, that was a nice try. It didn't work. It's not wasted money. It's learning.
that's occurred.
I've got another question. Carla Maribel asks, and this is referred to, you know, your remarks about integrating mitigation activities. She says, how will natural hazard mitigation activities be funded in light of the 9/11 Act, which prohibits the funding of non-terrorist activities?
Well, first of all, I think that there's going to be a broader – that can be fixed in legislation. Remember, we're not making a legislative proposal. We're saying how things should be. So in the course of that discussion, you can amend that if it's if there's a consensus among us that we should do that. And again, many things have a terrorism nexus. I mean, for example, if a bridge is important and you want to mitigate the bridge, the social value of the bridge may be that grandma's on the other side and that's how her groceries get to her and that's how her son and daughter get groceries to grandma once a week to make sure she, and check on her to make sure she's okay. The national defense value might be we need that bridge to connect nodes of the nation's defense. The actions you take to protect the bridge against terror can also be actions which have a benefit for a natural hazard or any accident that occurs. So there's a tighter linkage than one might think. And if we keep trying to parse these activities out into each narrow node, I think we limit the effectiveness and not increase the effectiveness. So that's a discussion that should be out there. Again, we aren't making a proposal for action so much as we're saying these are some concepts that need to be involved. And that's a good question, but we fully intend to engage with that. And quite honestly, I will tell you, I think from the officials of NEMA that I represent, we come down hard on the idea that anything like this that we suggest, we've got to be very, very strong in our support and loud in our support for mitigation of natural hazards as well as terrorism hazards. The 9/11 Commission didn't get everything right, and maybe they did the best they could, but it's been 10 or 12 years. We can take a look at that, too. I mean, that's part of this retrenching. What now makes sense?
And I want to point out, Carla, our last program, we had, Jim, we had David Miller on with us speaking about mitigation, and he's the one you succeeded, whose term was not finished off, and, of course, he's moved to FEMA, and we had an excellent program with him last time, which is in our archives, and he talked a good bit about integrating mitigation into everything that we do.
Yeah, I think it's the only way mitigation is actually going to survive. Only for our sanity and for our grant programs did we start breaking up mitigation preparedness, response, and recovery into these little silos. And frankly, it was one break in the chain. I actually have a slide from a previous presentation. I think Barb Graff, who's on the line, probably would remember it, where I built a house called Emergency Management, and there were four pillars underneath it, and I pulled the mitigation piece out, and it collapses in flames. But I think that's true. That the supply chain for emergency management starts with mitigation effort, if you want to think of it that way, and response and recovery. And if there's a break in any of those things, the whole system fails. So we need to see it holistically and not see it in our kind of narrower context.
Exactly. Okay, well, let's go ahead and wrap it up for today. Jim, on behalf of Ava Jean, myself, all our participants, thank you very much for joining us once again and sharing this information with us. And we also want to thank your assistant, Lee Root, for helping us prepare the program. And we wish you every success as you move forward with this and the rest of your term at NEMA and, of course, there in Washington State.
Thank you very much, and Lee says thank you, too.
Okay, great. Folks, before you go, please do take a moment to fill out our little feedback form here. And if you have additional thoughts or comments about, basically the grant process can be improved, please share them. Look for the link to Jim's blog. I'm sure he'd be happy to hear from you as well. Again, if you're not on our mailing list, just go to our homepage to subscribe, and then you will get our announcements. And you can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. Now, our next program is planned for June 27th, so please mark your calendar, watch your email, and plan to join us then. So until next time, thanks to everyone for participating today. Have a great afternoon. We are adjourned.